Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. What does it take to quickly develop a vaccine that the whole world is waiting for? The process usually takes more than a decade, but researchers around the world are pressing as hard as they can to accomplish what was previously unimaginable. Develop a vaccine for a virus that just several months ago was unknown to science, and do it in maybe just a year and a half. So how are they going to accomplish that? This hour on Point, science versus the coronavirus. And we will start today with a researcher who is at work on a potential vaccine. Dr. Dan Baruch joins us from Boston. He is director of the Center for Virology and Vaccine Research at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. He's also a professor at Harvard Medical School as well. Dr. Baruch, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna. It's good to be here.
So first of all, I mean, you and your team are at work on one potential vaccine out of several dozen that are currently in development. So I just wanted to acknowledge that there's a lot of different approaches going on around the world simultaneously right now. But take us into your lab. Where did you start in terms of deciding how might you go about developing a vaccine for the novel coronavirus?
Well, first, to put it in context, the explosion of COVID-19 over the last several months suggests that a vaccine really might be needed to end this pandemic. Vaccines are the ultimate game changer, and history is on the side of vaccines to end viral pandemics. So we started working on this in early January. Like many people, we saw the news of mysterious cases of pneumonia in China in early January, and the sequence of the virus was released on January 10th.
The DNA sequence or the RNA sequence, the genetic sequence of the virus.
Exactly. Yeah. The genetic sequence of the virus was released online, available to anyone in the world on January 10th. That was a Friday. That same evening, on Friday evening, our team started to analyze the sequence, and we worked through the weekend. And we looked at the sequences of the virus, compared it with the sequences of other related coronaviruses in the past, such as SARS and MERS. And we, as well as many other groups, were able to immediately identify the key region that we believe is important for antibody responses against this virus.
Okay, so let me
it's
just
called the spike protein.
The spike protein. So that's the protein that everyone's got the picture of a coronavirus in their head. It's the spike on the crown, essentially, that's around the spherical shape of the virus.
Yes. So the spike protein is the surface protein that you see basically sticking up and sort of sticking out from the virus when you look at a picture of it.
Okay. Do you mind if I ask, as far as I understand, you mentioned SARS and MERS, other coronaviruses as well, but we don't actually have a fully effective vaccine for any coronavirus thus far. Is that right?
That's correct. There are no clinically approved vaccines for any coronavirus. Coronaviruses is a class of viruses that includes many different members, many different types of viruses, including some viruses that just cause the common cold that are quite common, as well as more severe viruses that have emerged over the last two decades. The SARS virus, the first SARS virus in around 2003, and then the MERS virus around 2012. There has been a lot of vaccine research for SARS and MERS. However, those have not progressed to the point of a clinically approved vaccine. So there is a lot of scientific knowledge about SARS and MERS, as well as knowledge of immune responses. And it's really the building on the science that has been developed for SARS and MERS that gave us, as well as other vaccine groups, the ability to start vaccine research for COVID-19 very quickly.
So you have a large foundation of knowledge and of extant research to build from. Point well taken. But just to drive this home, have we ever seen in the history of modern medicine a vaccine for a previously unknown virus developed in a year and a half?
Absolutely not. Typically, it takes many years, often decades, to develop a vaccine to a new virus. So the hope to develop a vaccine that might be available by next year, if that happens, and that's still a big if, but if that happens, it will be the fastest vaccine development program for any pathogen ever in history.
Ever in history. Not just modern medicine, but ever in history. Just that is a remarkable fact. And yet it seems as if the global medical and scientific community thinks that it could be possible, or at least day by day as the research is being done, that is the goal. So let me ask you, though, going back to what you are doing in your lab, I should say, in partnership with Johnson & Johnson, when you said you looked at the original genetic sequence that was released by Chinese researchers and you identified a particular area of the viral genome that produces those spike proteins, what was it about those spike proteins that you felt was a good place or a good reason to focus on them as the tool to develop a vaccine?
So it's the region, the surface protein of the virus, and it's believed to be the target of antibody responses. So it's a logical choice to include in a vaccine. It's possible that future research will suggest that other proteins will also be important to include in a vaccine, but the spike protein is clearly the first choice.
Yeah. So would the vaccine, say yours is successfully developed and goes through all its clinical trials, essentially when a person gets the shot, would they be getting a shot of that protein and that would stimulate the immune response?
So there are groups that are utilizing that protein itself as a vaccine. Our own approach has been to insert the DNA encoding that region into a common cold virus. We use a safe, harmless common cold virus as a so-called vector, basically as a transport mechanism that shuttles the DNA of the coronavirus spike protein into cells. We do that because common cold viruses are very good at one thing, which is getting into cells. So it's a very efficient way of transporting the coronavirus spike protein DNA into cells. So what we did in the lab is we synthesized several different variants of the spike protein, and we inserted that into a common cold virus. That is then the vaccine. Uh-huh. And when that is injected into, say, a human's arm, then the common cold virus, together with the coronavirus spike protein DNA, is inserted into cells. Human cells make the spike protein, and then the body makes an immune response to it. Turns out that's a very efficient and potent way of raising high levels of antibodies against COVID-19.
Okay, interesting. So this is one strategy. I mean, I think there are other sort of general strategies for vaccine design. I mean, perhaps one of the oldest ones is giving a small dose of either low active or completely inactive virus or pathogen, right? Is that a potential strategy in vaccine development for a coronavirus?
According to the World Health Organization, there's over three dozen and maybe even four dozen different vaccine approaches. So there are many different strategies being pursued in parallel. Overall, that's a good thing because at this point in time, we don't know for sure which strategy is going to be the safest, the most effective, the fastest, and ultimately the most deployable for this global crisis. But those can be put into different categories. Some people are using DNA vaccines, DNA plasmids, as shuttles to bring key pieces of the coronavirus, such as the spike protein, into cells. Some groups are using RNA vaccines. Mm-hmm. Some people are using purified protein vaccines that we talked about. Some people are using recombinant vectors, such as I was talking about, the common cold virus, to help transport the key spike protein into cells. Other people are using inactivated viruses, a very tried and true vaccine strategy where you grow up the virus in the lab and you deactivate it, and then that is the vaccine. And there's some other innovative and creative approaches as well. So there's at least five or six different classes of vaccines that people are exploring for COVID-19.
So it's entirely possible that we could hopefully, I mean, knock on wood, have multiple successes with different types of approaches.
Many approaches will not reach the finish line.
Okay.
And many approaches that do show efficacy will have difficulty with global production and distribution of hundreds of millions or billions of doses of vaccine. But ultimately, if we do end up with more than one, if we do end up with two or three vaccines for COVID-19, that would be a good thing. Yeah.
So Dr. Baruch, you have been working on virology and vaccine research for quite a while. Does the efforts, do the global scientific efforts around a COVID-19, the development of a COVID-19 vaccine, does it compare to anything that you've seen before?
The intensity and the speed and the desire to do this well and to do this as fast as possible is truly unprecedented. Also, the need is unprecedented. So our team is working around the clock 7 days a week to try to accelerate this process as much as possible. I should emphasize that's without cutting corners, though, because yeah, ultimately safety of a vaccine is the single most important feature. But we do want to accelerate the process as much as we possibly can and do whatever we are able to help accelerate the development of a COVID-19 vaccine.
Well, so we're going to talk about how we safely accelerate a process that usually takes a decade, if not more. So Dr. Dan Baruch, Director of the Center for Virology and Vaccine Research at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, stand by for just a moment. We are talking with researchers about what the global scientific community is trying to do, an unprecedented effort to develop a vaccine in just a year and a half in the midst of a global pandemic. What is it going to take to do that? We'll hear more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with researchers who are attempting to develop a vaccine for the novel coronavirus. There are many groups of researchers and labs around the world who are working on this problem right now, an unprecedented effort in science to develop a vaccine faster than has ever been done before in the history of humanity. So let's listen to what Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, said recently about this. He spoke to Fox News last Wednesday about a vaccine that entered phase one clinical trials in Washington state last month.
Well, the vaccine is, as I've been saying over the past several weeks, I mean, we got into a clinical trial very, very quickly, faster than ever. A couple of other candidates are now entered into a phase one safety trial. In all, you know, you look at how long it takes to show safety and immunogenicity and ultimately protection. It's going to take about a year to a year and a half. If, in fact, there are still areas of outbreak throughout the world and we could test the vaccine to show efficacy, we may be able to truncate that time frame by a bit.
That's Dr. Anthony Fauci speaking to Fox News last Wednesday. Well, I'm joined today by Dr. Dan Baruch. He's director of the Center for Virology and Vaccine Research at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. He's with us from Boston, Massachusetts. And joining us now from Gainesville, Florida, via Skype is Natalie Dean. She's assistant professor of biostatistics at the University of Florida's College of Public Health and Health Professions. And she recently wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post about how to do smart clinical trials in the midst of a Pandemic, and we should have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Professor Dean, welcome to the program.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
So I wonder if you could explain to us just a little bit about, people hear phase one, phase two, phase three of clinical trials. Phase one, specifically, what is that? And generally, for a vaccine, how long does it take in quote-unquote normal times?
So phase one clinical trials are our first in human trials. They're typically pretty small, although we're seeing fairly large phase one trials here in this COVID pandemic. But the goal is to establish safety. That's the primary goal. And so it's relatively few people. They're monitored very closely. And so that takes, the time scales are all different here now. But here we're talking about a few months. And then phase two, the typical phase two trial, the focus is more on immunogenicity, so assessing an antibody response. So how likely is that product to induce an immune response? And then phase three trials.
Well, hold on there for a second, just
for
a second, Professor Dean, because I wanted to get Dr. Baruch's take on phase one and phase two. Phase three, we're going to spend a lot of time on, because that's the one where I think there's some innovative ideas around that. But Dr. Baruch, has your potential vaccine entered phase one clinical trials just yet?
Not yet.
Okay.
Our vaccine, which is based on a common cold virus as a carrier, I should emphasize the common cold virus does not cause a cold. It's perfectly safe. But that vaccine takes a few more months to manufacture because it requires the generation of seed stocks.
Right.
So that vaccine is expected to be in phase one trials in September of this year.
Okay, so it's coming up in the fall. As you heard Dr. Fauci say, he referenced a couple of the vaccines that did enter phase one trials last month. Just to double check me, Dr. Baruch, usually even just to enter phase one trial, does it require FDA approval for that?
It requires an FDA safe to proceed.
I see.
And so the FDA does need to review the proposal to proceed.
And are they fast-tracking those reviews now?
The FDA is looking at innovative ways to accelerate the process as well.
Okay. And just to underscore, this phase one is a safety phase, just to be sure that the vaccine does no harm in the patients that it's administered to.
Usually for phase one, as Natalie said, the primary goal is indeed safety. But I would say that virtually all vaccine manufacturers will also be very interested in looking at how robust immune responses are induced by the vaccine. It's a term that we would call immunogenicity. So safety is the primary goal, but manufacturers of vaccines will be very interested also in looking at immunogenicity of the vaccine.
Okay, so Professor Dean, a minute or two ago, I heard you say that immunogenicity is something that is typically measured or monitored in phase two. So are we seeing, in terms of an accelerated timeline here, a sort of collapsing of phase one and phase two together?
Yeah, I think that's a fair characterization. What we're seeing are fairly large phase one trials where that immunogenicity data is being collected as part of, you know, the same trial. And then I think what we might expect to see is the collapsing of sort of part of phase two and part of phase three. So instead of the three typical steps, we may be seeing something more like two steps. People are still working out exactly what this is going to look like, but the sort of the closely monitored first in human trials and then trying to accelerate moving into a field trial.
Okay.
That's what I'm seeing.
Yeah, so I want to we're going to talk about phase three in detail in just a second here. But Professor Dean, let me take a step back and I want to ask you the same question that I asked Dr. Baruch. Have you ever seen anything like this?
No, definitely not. Right. It's just because it's a new pathogen, everything is extremely accelerated. So, and just it's an unprecedented the scale of the pandemic, it requires this type of response.
And do you think, I mean, I'm pausing here because I still am stuck at this idea that we are realistically saying there could be an effective vaccine in just a year and a half, which seems to be a complete paradigm shift, a sea change from what was just presumed as normal and acceptable vaccine development timelines all the way until, you know, January of 2020. I mean, going from a decade to a year and a half seems amazing to me.
I think part of that is finding innovative ways to collapse the process as much as possible while still maintaining the rigor. So there are some things that require assuming more financial risk. So usually we wait for one stage to end and then before entering the next stage. Mm-hmm. But you can sort of start the next stage a little bit earlier, or at least start planning it. And so you assume some financial risk, because if that doesn't work out, then you've wasted some time and money. But when we're talking about trying to accelerate the process, you know, that's something that could be very beneficial. And the same conversations are happening with scaling up manufacturing.
I see. So we're going to talk about manufacturing in a second here. But so to go back to phase three, a phase three clinical trial usually takes the longest. And what is it that that researchers are looking for in phase three?
So phase three clinical trials are our field trials, where you actually go out and vaccinate people. So either people are either randomized to receive vaccine or placebo. And these are, you know, healthy individuals out in the community. And then we follow them over time. And the goal is to see, compare the rates of disease in the vaccinated group and the unvaccinated group. And so we're focusing on whether the vaccine actually works as intended to prevent disease. So that's different from the, you know, the exclusive focus on safety or an immune response. Of course, we're still focused on safety, but the goal is to assess efficacy. So does the vaccine work as intended?
Right. So just to sort of recap here, phase one, safety, and safety throughout the whole thing, but really safety as a first question. Then phase two, to get a measure of what kind of immune response is generated, and then phase three to see if it really works, if it prevents people from getting a disease. It actually is quite an elegant progression, and it makes a lot of sense. Now, you have done research on deploying phase three clinical trials in the middle of epidemics, Ebola, right? So what are the particular what was that like? How do you do a phase three trial when disease is sort of burning all around you?
Yeah, so I was part of the team that in 2015 designed an Ebola vaccine trial in Guinea. It used an innovative strategy where we vaccinated the contacts and contacts of people who were sick with Ebola. And so the idea was to identify a very high-risk population. So usually in vaccine trials, we just enroll people from the community and we vaccinate them and follow them over time. So this was a more flexible, highly targeted strategy. So we learned a lot of lessons from that experience, mostly that we need to be adaptive. And so one of the thoughts about how we can apply this to COVID vaccines is how we pick the sites that are in our vaccine trial. And so being very strategic about where we place the vaccine so we can maximize the chances that we're putting the vaccine where people are being exposed.
Well, so that's what Dr. Fauci seemed to be hinting at the end of that clip that we played, where he said, if in fact there are still areas of outbreak throughout the world in a year and a half, we can test the vaccine to show efficacy. We may be able to truncate that time frame for a bit. Is that what he was talking about?
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. And so then is there a way to continue to speed up the gathering of that information by, I mean, sharing the results between these different sites?
Yeah. So we recently published a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it was focused on doing clinical trials during outbreaks. And the basic idea is that the best strategy is not for there to be lots of little trials, but rather to have one big trial as much as possible, where all these different sites are contributing information to the same pool. And as a result, that speeds how quickly we enroll people, and that speeds how quickly we can get results. Because otherwise, if we just consider enrolling, you know, people from one area, then there's some chance that there won't even be an outbreak in that area. So the more sites that are able to participate, the more we distribute that risk and increase our speed.
So It sounds, Dr. Brook, let me turn to you on this. It sounds like then in that case, having an ongoing pandemic actually presents opportunities that you don't usually have when trying to develop a vaccine. Because if there are, even in the coming weeks, months, continued hotspots, there are more of them than you typically see. So that's a good opportunity in this case.
Yeah, well, there's clearly many challenges associated with doing clinical trials in the midst of a pandemic. But if they're conducted correctly, then a clinical efficacy trial of a vaccine can be conducted potentially much faster in an ongoing epidemic than an epidemic that is subsiding or subsided. Let me give you one example. We were also involved in developing vaccines for Zika virus in 2016. And indeed, there were a number of very good vaccine candidates that show very potent immune responses that we think are the right type. However, the Zika virus epidemic has largely waned. And so none of those vaccines could actually demonstrate efficacy in human populations. And so many of those vaccines are going to have to wait until a new outbreak of Zika virus before they can truly show clinical efficacy in the field. So in the context of an ongoing epidemic or pandemic, then if the incidence rate of the infection is high, then one can complete a clinical efficacy trial in a much shorter period of time than if the incidence rate is low.
Okay, so Dr. Dean, then Professor Dean, what I'm curious about is, you were talking about deploying the trial in multiple locations, cooperating and sharing information. If that's not typically how it's done, is there do we have sort of the research infrastructure set up to quickly move to this kind of accelerated model for a phase three trial?
It's definitely a shift in how things are done. It requires a lot more collaboration, and typically manufacturers, developers are like to sort of have very tight control over their particular trials. But we are advocating for a global strategy. So I'm part of a working group with the World Health Organization. So we've been working together for about 5 years, strategizing on best ways to do clinical trials during outbreaks. And we're working very closely together right now and making recommendations for the best way to run these trials. Mm-hmm. And what we suggest is this type of what we call a core protocol strategy, where we have international collaboration with many different countries. It's similar to what's happening right now with the WHO's Solidarity trial, which is a multi-country treatment trial. So it's the same group. And so we're thinking about ways that we can replicate that with a vaccine trial.
Okay, interesting. So, I should have asked you this a minute ago, so I'm going to backtrack a little, forgive me. But when you were talking about the work that you did on Ebola in Guinea, you talked about vaccinating in the phase three trial contacts of contacts, right? So can you explain, just explain quickly what that actually means?
Right. So, well, it helps that everyone's talking so much about contact tracing. People are probably more familiar with it than usual.
Yeah.
So basically, one of our key epidemiological strategies for containing a disease that's particularly one that spreads person to person is something called contact tracing. And so you identify a case that might be someone who's sick with Ebola that comes into the hospital or treatment center. And so once you identify that person, teams go out to where that person, is from and identifies everyone who's been in close contact with them, typically family members, neighbors, and then you can do a second order where you look at all those people who were contacts and look at who they've been in contact with. And so that identifies a set of people who are socially connected to the case and people who are likely at highest risk. And so those people were targeted for enrollment into the trial.
So the reason why I wanted to get clarification on that is because there has been aggressive contact tracing being done in some other countries. But if we were to launch a phase three trial here in the United States using the model that you just said, I mean, we're already not doing all that much contact tracing here. So researchers would have to be essentially starting from zero on that. That's kind of a problem, isn't it?
Yeah, well, to be clear, so we're not actually recommending this contact-based strategy for a vaccine trial. So that worked well for Ebola. Ebola, you know, really spreads very clearly, you know, person to person through pretty close contact. And also it spreads a bit more slowly, and it wasn't as distributed throughout the population the way COVID-19 is. So what we're proposing for this vaccine trial would be something more akin to a standard vaccine trial, in that you have geographical regions that are like hospitals or people who live near a hospital that are enrolled, but the flexibility is in which geographical areas that are participating in the trial.
I see. So Professor Dean and Dr. Baruch, stand by for just a second. I got a lot more questions for you. This is absolutely fascinating. We're talking about what it will take to develop a vaccine against the novel coronavirus. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we are going to be talking about the food in your grocery store and the supply chain that goes from the farm all the way to the shelves in your grocery store, and where in those supply chains we might be seeing vulnerabilities that could be even more vulnerable now with the COVID-19 pandemic. So if you work on a farm, you work in a grocery store, you work in logistics, anywhere in our food supply, give us a call and let us know, what are you seeing? Are you seeing some vulnerabilities, or is the supply chain as solid and reliable as ever? We're at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. What are you seeing at your grocery store? We're going to be talking about that on the show tomorrow. Today, we are discussing what it will take to develop a vaccine against the novel coronavirus in a history-making year and a half, if that's even possible, and how it might be done. And I'm joined today by Natalie Dean. She's assistant professor of biostatistics at the University of Florida's College of Public Health and Health Professions, and by Dr. Dan Baruch. He's director of the Center for Virology and Vaccine Research at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, Massachusetts. Dr. Baruch, how long do you think a phase 3 trial for a coronavirus vaccine might last before researchers feel confident that they know if the vaccine is effective or not?
It's hard to say, because it'll really depend on where the epidemic is at the time point that a phase 3 trial is conducted. Oftentimes, phase 3 trials take years, potentially many years. But in the setting of high amounts of transmission, then a phase 3 trial could take as little as a few months. So the time span varies dramatically depending on exactly where an epidemic is, both in terms of temporal time as well as in terms of geographic location at the time point that an efficacy trial is done.
So there are ways to, in fact, even further accelerate a phase 3 trial. And I'm thinking specifically of the possibility of using, I believe they're called human challenge trials, right? Where a test subject is given the vaccine and then also knowingly infected with the virus or pathogen that the vaccine is meant to to protect them from. It's done in very controlled circumstances, for sure. There are many, many ethical questions around doing that. But I have been reading papers that suggest that could it be a possibility in the case of COVID-19 if we really want to accelerate the time frame for a phase three trial? I mean, Dr. Baruch, what's your thoughts about that?
So controlled human challenge studies have been done for certain pathogens, such as malaria, influenza, typically pathogens in which there are immediate cures available with drugs, should there in the event that one of those human participants becomes ill. Typically, a human challenge model is not considered as robust data as a vaccine trial in the field, because even with that, it's not it doesn't exactly replicate the spread of the disease in the population. So a field trial for clinical efficacy is almost always preferable if it can be done. So in the setting of a pandemic, then at this point in time, most vaccine developers are going to plan to do clinical field trials.
I see. Professor Dean, did you want to give us your take on human challenge trials?
Yeah, it's certainly been an ongoing discussion, but I'm not convinced that it would necessarily be a faster route, given what we know about the state of the epidemic right now, that there are so many cases. And so maybe it would be more of a discussion if something like Zika happened, where that epidemic ended before we were able to assess the efficacy of a vaccine. And maybe at that time we would have effective treatments. Maybe we could have a version of the virus that's not as severe or is more well characterized, and we understand risks to different groups better. There's a lot more that we would want to have in place, I think, before pursuing human challenge trials.
Okay. So just to recap a little bit, Dr. Baruch walked us through not only the research that his team is doing and the particular approach to vaccine development that they're following, but the other approaches out there in the many dozens of labs at this moment that are trying to formulate a vaccine. And then we talked a lot about how to move that from outside, from the lab, to clinical trials, and how to really speed those clinical trials into the course of a year, whereas they usually take a decade. So let's presume for a moment that some of these vaccines come through phase three successfully, and we find that they are effective in protecting people against the novel coronavirus. So then what? Because I want to just play for you a clip from Bill Gates. On Sunday, he appeared on the show BBC Breakfast, and he talked a bit about what he believes happens after you have a working vaccine.
The efforts to test those, to build the factories, to understand, you know, is it safe and ready to go? That's a global problem. And, you know, so I'm glad, you know, that people are coming together to find where is the best work and combine that. You know, the factory will be in a different country than the science is in. This is the whole world working on probably the most urgent tool that's ever been needed.
That's Bill Gates on Sunday. Dr. Baruch, I'm seeing here that we could potentially want a billion doses of this new vaccine. Do we have the medical manufacturing infrastructure globally to produce that many doses in a short period of time?
Well, first, the need for a large number of doses is likely going to be related to the fact that to truly stop a pandemic, there will need to be herd immunity. Mm-hmm. A large fraction of humans in a population, in a community, and eventually the world will need to have immunity to the virus in order to stop the pandemic. So there is likely going to be a huge demand for the vaccine, and there will likely be a huge need for the vaccine. The ability to actually manufacture and distribute a vaccine in mass quantities is going to be ultimately responsible for the success or failure of such a vaccine. Many vaccines are very innovative, potentially effective, but many vaccines cannot be manufactured at the scale that might be needed for global delivery and deployment.
Why?
So it'll be very different according to different vaccine platforms. There's some more traditional vaccine platforms, there's some novel vaccine platforms, and some that have upscaling potential, and some in which the upscaling will have to be developed. But clearly, one of the fastest routes to a vaccine that's ultimately deployable for global pandemic control would be a vaccine in which there is a degree of confidence that manufacturing upscalability is feasible.
Okay, so can you briefly tell me why some vaccines are more easily upscaled than others, or more quickly able to be quickly deployed?
Some of it is experience. Okay. It often takes industry many, many years to develop the processes and develop the physical factories and to develop the procedures needed to manufacture a vaccine. Optimization of protocols, of cell lines, of purification schemes. That is not easy or straightforward or quick.
Okay, so protocols, quality control. What about also just the basic materials needed, the compounds needed to make these vaccines? Do we have enough of them?
That's a very good point. Making a billion doses of a vaccine is very, very different than making 1,000 or 10,000 doses of a vaccine. So the ability to make enough vaccine to show efficacy in humans is a completely different ballgame than making enough vaccine for global delivery.
And the reason why I'm asking is I'm just sort of leaning on my very sketchy knowledge of, say, the annual flu shot people get. Like that's cultured in eggs. Is that right?
Most of them still are. There are other methods now, but yes.
Yeah, and because I'm just wondering, like, are there basic fundamental materials that we almost never think about that are really crucial in the delivery of vaccines that all of a sudden we're going to be needing a lot of and just don't have? It sounds like you're saying yes.
Yeah, and it'll be different for different vaccine platforms. So we were discussing earlier how there are DNA vaccines, RNA vaccines, purified protein vaccines, recombinant vector vaccines, inactivated virus vaccines. Each of those classes of vaccines and each specific vaccine will have its own manufacturing needs and challenges.
Mm. So Professor Dean, let me turn back to you then, because one of the themes that you've brought to this table here is thinking in parallel, right? Like having the next phase of something, the development process ready to go, even before the previous phase has come to its completion. And I really like the elegance of that thinking. Should that also apply to the manufacturing end of things, if we're talking about really being able to get vaccines to people when they need them? Should, you know, companies like Johnson & Johnson, et cetera, be thinking right now about how to get their manufacturing facilities ready to go, as in when we have working vaccines?
That's a big part of the discussion. So after the Ebola epidemic, an organization was formed, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovation, CEPI. It's partly funded by the Gates Foundation. And one of its goals is to speed the investment or provide investment into some of these infectious diseases that cause outbreaks in development of vaccines. And so one of the things that group is discussing right now is how we can make investments into scaling up manufacturing even before we necessarily have all of the evidence that the product is effective. So like I said, that would, there would be some risks there, but the goal is to have something available at scale even earlier.
It would seem, though, that this is one situation in which the risks are worth it, right? I mean, that I think the entire, all of humanity is saying the risk is worth it.
That's the thought. So it's something that it's a new idea, right? But I think it's a good idea for this setting.
Huh. Now, do you think there's the possibility that researchers come through the other side of this and we have a successful an effective vaccine and hopefully medical manufacturing ramps up to meet the need, that what is learned now about vaccine development and about different ways to safely do clinical trials Could it change vaccine development permanently going forward, Professor Dean?
I think, you know, with each epidemic, we learn something new about, you know, there's going to be unique challenges. So there were unique challenges with Ebola, certainly, and there were unique challenges with Zika, and that, you know, each time we're setting sort of a new precedent. And so certainly we're going to learn a lot here about ways that, you know, under extraordinary pressure, that we can accelerate the process. I don't know that it'll necessarily, how much it'll change the normal process, right? Because there are reasons why we take very deliberate steps, you know, and we take pauses between steps in the normal process. But certainly, I'm sure there will be a lot of lessons learned.
Well, so Dr. Baruch, the deliberate nature of science and research, I completely understand. But you can imagine that if this is successful, people might ask authentically in the future, well, why should it ever take 10 years again?
I think that many aspects of the COVID-19 epidemic are rewriting the rules in many aspects of science and medicine. And I think that the speed at which vaccine development is progressing will have a lasting impact on the field. As Natalie was describing, one of the key aspects to accelerate the development of a COVID-19 vaccine is the willingness to take additional financial risk and incur large costs up front, specifically to start the large-scale manufacturing at an earlier stage, typically the most costly part of a process. And if resources are available and the will is available to start that process essentially now, before there's any data available whatsoever in humans, then there can be years shaven off of a vaccine development process. So I think that if the vaccine development process is successful for COVID-19, then it will demonstrate what could be done if and when needed, and if the world is willing to make the investment to do so.
Dr. Baruch, I'm curious, if you just sort of take off your lab head hat here for a second, and just looking at the global effort that's going on right now, do you ever just stand back and say, wow, we are doing this? And maybe you allow yourself to feel a little bit optimistic that it could happen.
We're cautiously optimistic, but we have so many challenges to solve every single day that I don't really have the luxury of taking my hat off.
But cautiously optimistic, though. So, Professor Dean, do you feel that same optimism, even if cautious, that even this really aggressive 18-month timeline, we might be able to actually meet it?
I'm cautiously optimistic, too. I mean, I'm just so impressed by all the people that I work with and how committed we are, and, you know, groups all across the world to working on this problem and, you know, finding a solution. And there's so much effort going on in parallel. There's a lot of collaboration between groups. I mean, it's really, we all understand the seriousness of this pandemic. And so we're responding, you know, proportionally.
Proportionally. Well, the proportions are massive now, right?
Yeah,
it's a global, historic global pandemic. And so therefore, the response is massive as well from the scientific community. So Natalie Dean, Assistant Professor of Biostatistics at the University of Florida's College of Public Health and Health Professions. We have a link to Natalie's writing about innovative ways to accelerate clinical trials. That link is at onpointradio.org. Professor Dean, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Dr. Dan Baruch, Director of the Center for Virology and Vaccine Research at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, Massachusetts. Dr. Baruch, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.